Good afternoon. Welcome to Division One of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our 130 docket for today. And the first case we have is case number 09336, which is Lee versus DeWitt. Counsel are here and ready on that case. Okay. And we have a handout that we normally provide that covers our practice and procedures. Here, have both of you been able to review those? And do you have any questions on any of that?
Judge, I'm familiar with those policies and I have no questions.
Okay.
When would I have received a
handout? From the bailiff. It just goes over our timing procedure. Both sides have 15 minutes. At the podium, there's a lever on the podium so you can raise it or lower it to fit what you need. There's a lighting system now. When the green light goes on, that starts your time for your 15 minutes. When the yellow light comes on, that means you have 5 minutes left. And when the red light is on, that's the end of your time. Appellant has the opportunity to reserve the amount of time that you might want for rebuttal. If you want me to help you hit that mark that you want to reserve, let me know. Otherwise, it's just up to you to stop when you want to and save some time for your rebuttal. We would ask everyone in the audience if you have a telephone or a pager or any other kind of device that might beep or go off during the arguments, if you would please make sure that those are turned off or put on vibrate mode. The arguments are broadcast on the internet, so if there's anything, I don't think there's anything especially sensitive in the cases that we have on the docket today, but if so, you might want to keep that in mind as far as using names or any other remarks that you have that you might not want to have broadcast on the internet. Other than that, we are ready to proceed if counsel is ready. Any questions, sir?
No questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
Judge, I may reserve some time, but I don't think I need a signal on that. If I do a good job, hopefully I won't need to be interrupted, and we'll see how this goes. But I please the court. My name is Robert Bruce, and I'm here as counsel for Michael Lee. And we're here today to have you look at a case where we believe the case presents to the court an effort to expand the damages for a breach of contract action. I believe that the law has been evolving such that the how you distinguish between tort and contract claims is becoming more and more clear and more definite as dictated by the Colorado Supreme Court and rulings of this court. However, the district court's decision in this case to have awarded the damages on both breach of contract, the civil theft claim, and the fraud claim attempts to blur those distinctions, which are now becoming even more clear. Here, the trial court found that Mr. Lee breached his contract with Ms. DeWitt and awarded $63,583.81. That was the benefit of the bargain for which there was a breach of contract that the judge found compensatory damages. Now, to go beyond that, to analyze some of the other claims, the alternative claims for relief, is where the court erred in not realizing what this distinction would do. What the failure to recognize the distinction went on to say, wait a minute, this was something more than a breach of contract, and we think that there should be a trebling of those damages. All of a sudden, the alternative theories upon which the claims were based became merged into one theory supporting the entirety of the award. The claim for civil theft is based upon the breach of the contract. Here, there is an argument that Mr. Lee, when he breached his contract, he did so and that he thus stole some property, as opposed to the fact of what really happened here is that the parties entered into a voluntary contract to sell certain property, and that contract for the required the payment of about $10,000, and an option to repurchase at some later date. That $10,000 payment, we believe, is critical to the analysis of this case to distinguish it from cases which would allow for an award of civil theft. Remember, the civil theft statute here doesn't say that one of the bases upon which civil theft can be brought is a subsequent breach of contract. It has to be on the theft, the robbery, or the burglary of some other property. We believe that in our reply brief, we have set forth examples of how this case is so much different than the other cases which are cited where there may be theft by deception. In each of those cases of theft by deception, you will note that there is an illusory promise, a fraudulent promise, or no promise at all.
Well, Mr. Bruce, are you suggesting that those cases cover the universe of possible circumstances for theft by deception?
No, they do not. But I point that out to use a distinguishing factor here, that there was real and valuable consideration in the payment of this mortgage loan. Remember what had happened here, and the facts seem to be undisputed, is that Mrs. DeWitt had a problem with her existing lender. That lender was demanding payment on a defaulted note. That was a payment that was of great distress for her, and it was important for her to try to make sure that that payment got paid before the mortgage lender had died. So Mr. Lee went through a title company and made the payment, paid off her loan, and gave her the benefit of not having to repay that debt. Now, the record certainly supports and does reflect that he didn't then allow her to repurchase it. That was what the court found and what really is the basis of the breach of contract claim. So no, Judge, it does not say that's the universe of things. But what I think has happened here is that we've effectively criminalized breach of contract through the use of the treble damages statute in this particular case. So to answer your question is no, those cases aren't everything, but certainly this case gives you factual basis to say that it is not supported under the statute.
Because Mr. Bruce, sorry to interrupt. Just a quick question. Didn't the deception occur before any contract?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't see that that is resolved in the trial court's decision. He does say that it was by deception, and so there is some implication that it could have been beforehand. But because of the fact that there was also the payment of consideration and a finding of a breach of contract, it would seem to me that, again, it criminalizes breach of contract. The court had the option here of saying, no, this wasn't a contract, that it was merely a fraudulent situation, and that these people didn't have a meeting of the minds.
But isn't that the essence of what the judge found?
No, I disagree. I think that he found that there was a contract and thus awarded the compensatory damages as you would with a contract, and went the next step to say, oh, and by the way, I'm going to also award the civil theft damages and find that it was fraud, thus changing these alternative theories into one big theory, which is the basis of what I believe the policy arguments that I'm making today justify a reversal of that decision.
Didn't the judge conclude and find that Mr. Lee did not intend or ever intend to allow Ms. DeWitt to repurchase the property, even when he wrote into the contract that there would be a repurchase within 1 year of the date of the contract?
The judge has the finding of that, which I don't think is explicit as you have just made it, Judge, but I can say that you can read the order to that effect. But if that's the case, then it's a fraud claim and not a contract claim. And thus, the breach of the contract claim, the ultimate conclusion of breach of contract, fails. That's what I'm trying to say is that it's the blurring of these theories which has resulted in the extraordinary relief of granting the treble damages in this case. I think that there was a confusion on the district court's part as to whether these were alternative claims of deferred relief or not, or whether that by their nature they should be alternative claims. Once the breach of contract was found and that it was a contract supported by consideration was found, I believe the analysis should have stopped there.
Why couldn't the trial court have stated that this was a civil theft claim and measured the damages based on the breach of contract and then treble the damages under the civil theft statute?
Well, the trial court could have done that, but that's not what the trial court did in this particular case. They could have said that the compensatory damages was that amount and determined to do so, but to have done so would have ignored the real monetary value of the payment that was made to Ms. DeWitt's lender. he got her out of that problem that she was facing at the time. In other words, the foreclosure of that home or the requirement to repay this lender on a defaulted loan, which she had no alternative for.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it seems to me that, based on the case law that says that we can affirm the trial court for any reason, if the trial court misstated it or improperly said that there was a breach of contract, and it sounds like you're conceding that the trial court could have reached the same amount of damages just under the civil theft cause of action. Am I misunderstanding what you're saying?
No, Your Honor, and your point's well taken, but let me answer it by saying this, is because the trial court also made the factual conclusion that there was a contract and that it was breached, that you can't make that extra step and ignore that conclusion any more than you can say, well, he was right, but he was right for wrong reasons. You can say that, but then it's antithetical to his actual factual findings on the existence of a contract.
So is your position then that you can't have a civil theft claim at all whenever there's a contract?
Whenever there's a valid contract. If you could find in certain circumstances that the parties entered into a contract, but then you would have said it's void because it was based upon a civil theft, you know, something that was false. I think one of the cases that were cited by the defendant here is that there was a contract, but it was based upon the false information of some reports that just were made up, as opposed to the actual valuable consideration, which was paid at the closing in this transaction.
Was that particular argument presented to the trial court?
I did not make a motion for reconsideration, so it really wasn't until after the decision came down that I came up with that argument, and since there was no motion for reconsideration, the answer is no.
And is that particular argument that you're asserting now made in your briefs?
Well, I think the reason I asked for the oral argument is I think the answer is yes, it is, but I'm trying to refine it for you to give you the better understanding in my oral argument as to the public policy reason why I believe that this court went beyond what it should have done in its decision. And I also base that, go on to say that's true of the fraud claim too. That's why I argue on the fraud claim that we have the economic loss rule applying. Again, to go back to where I started with in my argument, is that I think that this was an attempt to blur the lines of tort and contract, taking alternative claims and making them both contract and both tort, and thus improper. And thus, I've cited to you the case law that says the economic loss rule should have been applied in this circumstance as opposed to ignored.
Well, I recall your argument in your briefs about the economic loss rule and the effect that it might have on the breach of contract claim and the fraud claim. However, I do not recall your argument in your brief about merging the line between contractual obligations and the rights in stolen property statute.
As I indicated, that's really the reason I wanted to make that public policy. The reason I asked for the oral argument was to make the public policy argument. And it wasn't as clear in my brief to tie that public policy together, but that's why we were arguing the emphasis of once there was a breach of contract found, the analysis should have stopped there, as opposed to going on to effectively treble the award of a breach of contract damages.
So just so I understand, you are saying that the court trebled the award, which arose from the breach of contract.
That's how I understand the district court's decision to have effectively done in this case. Found a breach of contract, said this is the benefit of the bargain, but because I'm also faced with a rights and stolen property claim, I'm going to treble that award. And that we think was improper because it basically criminalizes breach of contract.
But wasn't the amount of damages trebled under and by reason of the rights and stolen property statute?
It was, but my position is they should have never gotten to that, the trial court should have never gotten to that position, because once he found a breach of contract, we believe it was improper to go to the next step and say that the rights of stolen property statute even could apply as an alternative theory of relief.
Okay.
So I'll conclude reserving myself a couple of minutes by noting that there doesn't seem to be a disagreement that the trial court did err here. They erred at least in the minimum of not properly calculating the interest award. And we believe that that in and of itself justifies that there should be a reversal of the decision, at least as to that matter, and also any arguments for prevailing party attorney's fees not to be awarded in this case, because, you know, we've had to appeal that part of the decision at a bare minimum. I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
You have about 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. David Cosma on behalf of Mr. Witt, the plaintiff in the underlying action. Mr. Witt was 68 years old and had a 10th grade education at the time of trial. She purchased the subject property in 2002 for $90,000, put $60,000 down, and then the owner carried a note for $30,000. She paid off that note to the tune of $20,000 and had a balance of $10,000 in 2004. It was income property. She had renters in the property. And coincidentally, Mr. Lee, an old acquaintance, came back into her life at that time and was bragging about all the money he had. And she approached him for a loan for $10,000 to pay off the balance on that income property. Her renters were not paying rent. She was in default. She was afraid the property was going to go into foreclosure. She thought she was getting a loan from Mr. Lee. He showed up with real estate documents that he wrote himself. He testified that it was unusual for him to do so, to fill out a real estate contract on his own. And when she confronted him, she said that she wanted language in there, that she had the option to repurchase within a year. He not only put that language in the real estate contract, he put it in a separate agreement. It was labeled sale of personal property, but the only property referenced in that document was the real estate, the subject property. So at the time, Mr. Lee, he drove by the house once, never went inside. There was no discussion about a, quote, purchase price. Mr. Witt trusted Mr. Lee. And 1 month after he acquired that property from Mr. Witt, he took $80,000 in equity out of that property in the form of an equity loan, pledged the property as security for that loan in a $20,000 certificate of deposit. Before the year was up, he put the property on the market and sold the property before 1 year was up. When Mr. Witt was going through a divorce in 2004, and her divorce was finalized, she sold the house that she was living in and was ready, willing, and able to repurchase the property that was sold to Mr. Lee. She had bank statements that indicated that she had $20,000 in December of 04 in her savings, or in her checking, excuse me, and $24,000 in her savings. She continued to maintain at least $20,000 in a savings account through April of 2005. She approached Mr. Lee. She tried to approach him in December of 05 to repurchase the property. He wouldn't respond to her calls. When she finally got a hold of him in January of 05, she stated she wanted to repurchase. He put her off, said, I've got another property for you. She found out it was on the market in March of 05, and she said, I want to buy that property. That's my
house. Mr. Cosma, let me interrupt you there, if I might.
Sure.
It's my understanding from the appellant's briefs that one of the contentions that they are making here is that the trial court erred in entering a judgment in your client's behalf on her fraud claim because of the applicability of the economic loss rule. Can you address and respond to,
sure, Your Honor,
to that, please?
Yes, I can. The economic loss rule and claims for intentional torts are not mutually exclusive. duties that arise are two separate duties. Duties that arise under a contract, in this case for performance to resell the property within 1 year, and then there are duties under tort. Mr. Lee's duties to act in a honorable and honest fashion, a duty not to cheat, lie, or steal. The court found that Ms. DeWitt proved her claim for fraud and also proved her claim for civil theft. Where a breach amounts to an independent, willful tort, punitive damages may be recovered. That's the law in, here in Colorado. That's Mortgage Finance versus Podolsky, 742 P. Second 900, Colorado, 1987. Okay. Common law fraud claims based on a violation of a duty independent of contract. So you have two separate duties. It's the conduct surrounding the formation of the contract that gave rise to these duties. Mr. Lee's conduct was not only fraudulent, it was deceitful at the time of the formation of the contract. Ms. DeWitt proved both her fraud and theft claims. To hold otherwise, it allow someone to enter into a contract and also create fraud, and the perpetrator could use the excuse, well, it's just a breach of contract claim. That's contrary to established Colorado case law. In Brody versus Bach, 897 P. Second, 769, Colorado, 1995, the court stated, the gravamen of Brock's fraud claim is not Brody's breach of alleged oral agreement. The gravamen of the fraud claim is the allegation that Brody knowingly made a false representation concerning a present intention to perform a future act. That's analogous to the facts here. There's a false representation as to a future act, that Ms. DeWitt could repurchase the property within a year, when Mr. Lee, the court found in this findings of fact, that he had no intention to sell that property back to Mrs. DeWitt. The fact.
What about the appellant's claim that when he didn't sell the property back to Mrs. DeWitt, that was a pure breach of contract. It breached the obligation that he had under the written terms of the contract. Well, and why don't the damages just arise out of that breach of contract, or the duty arise out of that breach of contract?
Because the duty under contract was for performance. The duty under tort, and in this case intentional torts, arose out of statute. Colorado law has stated that you could have duties arising both out of common law and out of statute. So the duties aren't mutually exclusive, and you can use that, you can have a breach of contract, and in this case the court found that Mr. Lee breached his contract with Ms. DeWitt, and that was the threat, that the basis for troubling the damages were the damages for the breach of contract. But you can have a breach and theft. He breached his contract, but he also stole by deception. So they're not mutually exclusive.
Well, Mr. Cosma, let me ask this.
Sure.
If it was by deception, is it logical to say there was a meeting of the minds?
So there's a meeting of the minds as to Ms. DeWitt is entering into a contract that she thinks she'll be able to repurchase the house within a year. Okay. Mr. Lee had no intention of doing that. So I don't know if that answers your question. I can't draw the conclusion from that.
Okay.
This is still Brody versus Bach. The fact that such alleged representations constitute the substance of Bach's breach of contract claim does not require dismissal of his tort claim. The gist of the fraud action is Bach's change in position and justifiable reliance on Brody's knowingly false statement. The content of the fraudulent statement is material not for the purpose of requiring Brody to perform, but for the purpose of establishing that Bach acted reasonably but detrimentally in justifiable reliance upon the false statement. A contrary conclusion would encourage and condone fraudulent behavior. So that case is on point with this case. Now, Mr. Lee seems to argue that as far as there was no theft, and because something of value was given in the exchange, that being $10,000 for the property in the initial transaction. Well, there's Colorado case law. Inton versus, oh, I'm sorry, it's the wrong case. People versus Parga. Parga was an attorney in Colorado representing a beneficiary of an estate and involved estate property. And the estate property was a ranch in southern Colorado. He created a straw sale for $51,000 where actually he was purchasing the property instead of a third party. And he did this at a time where he knew the property was worth there was an offer on the property 3 years earlier for $126,000. And the court held that that was theft by deception. And it's People versus Parga, 535 P. Second, 1127, Colorado, 1975. That's analogous to the facts here. There's consideration given, but it's still deception, just like in Parga. There was a purchase of a ranch. There was consideration given, but Parga concealed the fact from his client that there was an offer on the same property for $126,000 3 years prior. Restatement Torts, Section 355, also allows for the award of punitive damages in the context of a breach of contract case.
Mr. Cosma?
Yes.
You have just said that you could have punitive damages in certain cases where there are claims for breach of contract. Are you aware of any reported decision where there was a judgment for breach of contract and also an award of treble damages under the civil theft statute?
I don't offhand, Your Honor. There may be a case. I'm just...
But your view is that by the same principle that would allow punitive damages, a party could obtain treble damages.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, even because the breach allows you to calculate the amount, the basis for calculating the treble damages. So you can have a breach of contract, and then also a claim for theft, a claim for fraud associated with that contract. Restatement of Torts, Second, Section 355, punitive damages are not recoverable for a breach of contract unless the conduct constituting the breach is also a tort for which punitive damages are recoverable. I don't know if that answers your question directly, but I think it indicates that these claims can coexist. And I don't think it's inconsistent to take a tort claim where you...
Mr. Cosma, I remind you that your time is up.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I would ask that the court affirm the trial court's decision and award attorney's fees pursuant to the paragraph 20 of the real estate contract in question. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bruce, you have about 2.5 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Cosma had, in his recitation of the facts, indicated that Ms. DeWitt thought that this was a loan, and there's certainly evidence in the record to support that she originally wanted a loan, but clearly the evidence in the record reflects that she knew that this was a real estate sales transaction by the time that she signed the contract and the deed. And we've cited that for you in our brief, and that appears at the record at pages 575, 594, 599, and 600. Clearly she knew that this was a sales transaction, in other words, a contract to sell this property. I'd like to address that issue of the punitive damages, which Mr. Cosma had gone into. The case law says that you don't get punitive damages for breach of contract. There are some restatement discussion of that, which I don't believe has been adopted. And to answer Judge Tomlin's question, I'm not familiar with any case where punitive damages were awarded for a breach of contract, or a case where there was a breach of contract and thus also a trebling of those damages. Here it seems that that morphing of the tort law and the contract law is what I'm hearing again in this argument.
Mr. Bruce, in the Town of Alma case on the economic loss rule, didn't the Supreme Court indicate that there could be a claim for in tort in addition to a claim for breach of contract?
Yes, when there is an independent contractual duty. And we see that that independent contractual duty exists in the sale of homes on a first-time home sale. We don't necessarily see that that independent contractual duty has been expanded into a commercial real estate contract over investment properties.
Excuse me, do you mean an independent tort duty in addition to the contract?
Yes, and that's why I think that when you read that Town of Alma case, they distinguish other possible negligence claims that can be brought by a homeowner against a builder or contractor. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but what I am saying that under the facts of this case, it's not possible. That's our position and why we believe that that rule was violated in this case. It seems to me, as I was indicating, that there's a morphing of these punitive damages concept. It's important to note the trial court threw out the punitive damages claim pretrial, and to somehow say that it got resurrected in the case is antithetical to me. We believe that the benefit of the bargain rule should be applied on the basis of the contract and that there shouldn't be a award of the treble damages in this case, and request that Your Honors reverse accordingly. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will be issued in due course. And as soon as counsel have cleaned up your files and vacated counsel's table, we'll ask the next case counsel to approach. And that is the case of Co-West